From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet one of America's most iconoclastic stage directors, Peter Sellers. He's directing the Los Angeles Festival. Comic David Brenner is in the Book of Lists for being on more TV talk shows than any other entertainer. Today he gets a crack at doing Fresh Air. Also, critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews comic Margaret Smith. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev has just arrived at Andrews Air Force Base to begin 4 days of talks in a super summit with President Bush. Secretary of State James Baker is standing by to greet the Soviet leader as he steps off the plane. Before leaving Ottawa, the Soviet president complained about the NATO position on German unification. Richard Reynolds has this report.
Gorbachev said that he had heard the same proposals from Western leaders so many times they were beginning to sound like a broken record. Prime Minister Brian Mulroney had delivered the same line on German unification that the Soviet president will hear in Washington. The Bush administration and the NATO alliance insist that a united Germany be a full member of NATO. This afternoon, Gorbachev said that the United States was attempting to dictate to the Soviet Union. Gorbachev said that was unacceptable and the West had better come up with some fresh proposals. There is room to negotiate, he said, and a solution can be found. But Gorbachev warned that the result will not be the one the West wants. Gorbachev also used a press conference to lash out at the leaders of the Soviet Baltic republics. He called them thieves and liars and said their calls for independence were irresponsible. For National Public Radio, I'm Richard Reynolds.
In the Soviet Union, the newly elected president of the country's largest republic gave notice that he's ready to battle the Soviet government for control of the Russian Federation. Boris Yeltsin denounced Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev's new economic reform program and called for the resignation of the Soviet government. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
Yeltsin described a vision of power in the Soviet Union that's certain to irritate President Gorbachev. He said Russia's laws should take precedence over those of the Soviet Union. He said he's ready to negotiate treaties with other Soviet republics as well as with foreign countries. And he said Russia someday should have a seat in the United Nations. Yeltsin said Russia's secession from the Soviet Union can't be ruled out. That's not our goal now, he said, but the central government shouldn't forget that it's a possibility. Yeltsin's bold statements were packed with criticism of Gorbachev and his new economic package. But Yeltsin offered no economic panaceas himself, leaving it unclear how he'll run Russia once he gets down to the business of being president. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
Nicaragua's Contra rebels agreed today to resume their demobilization after the government of Violeta Chamorro promised significant new concessions. In talks yesterday, the government agreed to set aside rural areas for the disbanded Contras to live in and to allow them their own police force. Despite some early profit-taking today on Wall Street, stock prices pushed to a second straight record high. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 8 points to close at 2,878.56. Declines and advances were about even in heavy trading. This is NPR News. At least 67 people were killed today in a strong earthquake that struck northeastern Peru. Civil defense officials say the quake, measured at 5.8 on the Richter scale, also injured hundreds of people and destroyed several towns in a jungle area. Officials say there's no telephone communication with much of the area damaged by the quake. An Air Force plane left for the area of the disaster this afternoon, carrying a team of 10 doctors and emergency supplies. Officials report there have been a series of aftershocks, including one that measured 5.1 on the Richter scale. Romania's worst earthquake in 13 years today left 8 dead and 260 injured. The quake that rippled across eastern Europe from Yugoslavia to Moscow registered 6.8 on the Richter scale at its epicenter in eastern Romania. From Bucharest, Kathleen Hunt reports.
High-rise buildings rippled and swayed for nearly a minute in the capital, and hunks of concrete and plaster rained down the facades of many of the hulking complexes erected by the executed dictator Nicolae Ceausescu. Two deaths and 50 injured are reported in the eastern city of Braila, about 40 miles from the Danube Delta. Bucharest appears to be the hardest hit, with two dead and 150 injured, yet it escaped the full-scale demolition it suffered 13 years ago. One factory reported a caved-in ceiling, but fortunately in a part of the plant that was closed today. Two people were killed when balconies fractured and fell to the ground, and others were gravely injured when they jumped through windows to get out of their buildings. For National Public Radio, this is Kathleen Hunt in Bucharest.
New Jersey Governor James Florio today signed into law what he said is the toughest ban on semi-automatic weapons in the nation. The governor ignored the chants of angry demonstrators as he signed the measure, which has been vigorously opposed by the National Rifle Association. The law bans the sale of new semi-automatic weapons. It requires state residents to register all the assault weapons they currently own and gives them 1 year to sell or deactivate the guns. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Peter Sellers is one of America's most controversial theater directors. His work has been described as extraordinarily original. It has also been called shallow horseplay. Sellers is best known for his radically updated interpretations of classic theater and opera. In his production of The Mikado, Nanki Poo charged a bribe on his American Express card. In Sellers' Così fan tutte, the heroes disguised themselves as the Blues Brothers. Sellers was only 26 when he became the director of the American National Theater at the Kennedy Center in 1984. He had already served as the director of the Boston Shakespeare Company. Now he's in Los Angeles, heading up the Los Angeles Festival, which will run for the first 2 weeks in September. The festival will showcase the ethnic diversity of the city, focusing on the work of new immigrants from Hispanic and Asian countries. Sellers is known for trying to shake things up in theater. I asked him if he thought theater was heading up dead ends when he started.
Well, I mean, the main thing was, you know, theater just wasn't where the action was. The action has been in music, the action has been in dance, the action has been in film, and the visual arts have kind of been taking off. But, you know, theater is still, you know, mostly doing what our grandparents did, and that's not that interesting. I mean, it's interesting every once in a while, but really, that has to be something. There has to be a little more action. And so I think what my generation was looking for was another level of action in theater that was as interesting as movies or was as much fun as going to a concert.
So if theater wasn't where the action was, what kept you there trying to make it the place where the action was?
Oh, you know, that thing about the cornerstone that the builders rejected. I mean, in a way. The fact that theater was so out of it was one of the things that made it a little bit interesting. And you always think, well, you know, let's invest now and see if in a while, you know, something doesn't come back.
So what would you say about the state of theater today? Do you feel better about it?
Well, in this country, theater mostly doesn't exist very much, except as a kind of nostalgic episode for a certain group in the audience. But most people my age don't really go to theater or think about it or enjoy it, or they remember it as something they did in high school, and that's fine. I think something else is going to come. I think, frankly, as things move farther and farther out of control and the sort of the large national spectrum and international spectrum, people are going to want to rethink their lives locally and begin to look for real direct human contact and a way of creating a local discussion of a specific issue. And that can't be done in a movie. That has to do with people who live together or near each other, thinking about that and talking about that and expressing it. That's theater.
That maybe leads us to the Los Angeles Festival. Now, what you're doing is focusing on arts from people of Los Angeles, and you're focusing primarily on Hispanic and Asian communities, but you're also importing art from around the country, mostly from Pacific Rim countries, I believe.
Well, our big question was what really is the Pacific Rim? All the economists tell us, of course, that the next century is the Pacific century and that Los Angeles is going to overtake New York in the next 15 years as the cultural and economic capital of the United States of America. The question is, you know, does L.A. act like it? Well, no. And, you know, anyone living here would be hard-pressed to imagine this place was the capital of anything. At the same time, you know, clearly it is an emerging century. Something is in motion, even if most of the people who are in its midst can't notice it. So the question of the Los Angeles Festival is, can we spend the next 10 years actually getting ready for the next century and what's about to overtake us? And can we not just be overtaken by it, but can we actually have a hand in shaping it? What's interesting in Los Angeles, of course, are the demographics. Obviously, who lives here? You know, the largest Korean population outside of Korea, the largest Filipino population outside the Philippines, the largest Salvadoran population outside of Salvador, the largest Mexican population outside of Mexico, the largest Japanese population outside of Japan, the second largest Jewish population outside of Israel, the second largest Black population in America, the largest Native American population in America. You know, you can go on down the list. Everyone lives here. And that's fantastic. I mean, it's quite an amazing opportunity, because this is either the ultimate Tower of Babel or the beginning of the first new society.
Well, and it is a time where I think racism has really been getting uglier than it has in quite a while. And I wonder if you think that a multicultural arts festival can act against that kind of racism.
Culture is always the product of heat, is always the product of friction. And obviously, one of the reasons why New York was such an important cultural crucible was because, you know, life was violent on the Lower East Side. And the kind of clash of immigrants has always been absolutely crucial to keeping a kind of cultural edge. In L.A., yes, it would be the hope to send a lot of this energy away from simple street violence and into something that actually had a positive impact on the future here and on people's lives. And that of course, is cultural, because culture is invented as a way that people who don't know each other have a chance to have something in common and talk and argue, but argue in a way that, you know, theater was created so you could argue about something without killing anyone. At the end, everyone gets up for the curtain call.
Peter Sellers is my guest. He's a theater director. He directed the opera Nixon in China, and he's known for his contemporary reinterpretations of Shakespeare and classic operas. And he's now directing the Los Angeles Festival, which will take place in September. Tell me if you think it's paradoxical at all that you, a white middle class, Harvard-trained theater director who usually uses European high art forms like opera and Shakespeare, is suddenly directing this, you know, multicultural festival that's really getting you away from European high art. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do. I mean, of course. I mean, I still earn my living by directing Mozart operas.
Right,
which is
right.
Quite wonderful. And I've just come from 6 weeks at Glyndebourne, opening their season there with the Magic Flute, and to come from the sort of the downs of Sussex, and opera in black tie and sipping champagne by the pond, back to South Central Los Angeles is quite a leap. At the same time, I have to say, this is what we're all going to be eating dinner off of. I mean, the whole point is that Mozart becomes American culture when I do it. I mean, my point when I direct Mozart is it belongs to us. We're Americans. It's part of our culture and cultural inheritance. And it happened because this is a country of immigrants, and so what is our culture is the sum total of what people have brought here and what is of value to people living here. So we have another wave of immigration, and that brings with it another wave of culture in the same way that, you know, the Los Angeles Philharmonic playing Debussy is American culture. In the next century, classical Chinese opera or Korean shaman or you know, any number of these traditions will be American. In fact, they are now. And that's what's interesting, is just noticing that America is in motion. You know, the country is truly not sort of stagnating at the rate of its politicians. The country is way out ahead and moving faster every day.
Perhaps what you're best known for internationally is your reinterpretations, your updated versions of opera, of Shakespeare, of other classics. But you're also very well known for your opera Nixon in China, which is one of the things that will be staged at the Los Angeles Festival.
Yes.
And the opera was your idea, and you asked John Adams to write the music for it. You had done this after already updating a lot of other operas, and I was wondering what initiated the idea for you to, well, write something of your own that was set in contemporary times.
Well, what's so interesting is that the thing that most of us don't know much about is our events that have happened within our own lifetimes. It's odd, but the historical sense has really yet to kick in. And now that news is so instant, you know, something is a headline or a couple-minute or 30-second blurb on a news program, then people think, oh, well, we understand that now, and they move on, and everything gets lost in the shuffle again. And really one of the hardest things to do is to examine a contemporary event with any range of depth. And I have to admit, it struck me that it was well worth reviving the genre of historical opera as a way of enabling these events to loom as large in our minds as maybe they loomed in history, and to begin to be felt with some three-dimensionality.
The classic operas that you've staged, you've updated in various ways. Don Giovanni carrying a switchblade. Which was the opera that was? It was Figaro that was set, I think, in the 53rd story.
Giovanni was in Harlem, and Così fan tutte was in a diner in Westchester, and so on. Yes.
Tell me about your reasons for doing that while keeping the language and the music the same. In other words, the ideas haven't changed. You even have the singer singing in the language
Italian.
It was written in, right?
Yeah.
So
Italian,
so singers
yeah.
are singing in Italian, but the story is updated and it's set in Trump Tower. So like part of it's updated, part of it isn't. And in fact, an audience who didn't understand Italian wouldn't even get what the singers were singing about.
Right. The beauty of opera, and you know, the reason to me it feels like real life, is that it's simultaneously immediate and remote. You're getting a very intense vibe, a very immediate emotional impact. The music really does, you know, speak to you as directly as possible. You can't miss it. At the same time, people are singing. They're not talking. And that already sort of raises the level of what's going on to something that's more abstract, more beautiful, and not just realistic, not just naturalistic. But it moves to a higher reality zone, as it were. The impact of opera is that it acknowledges that actually beauty is hidden and truth is hidden. These are things that are not available on the surface, that are the result of study, that are the result of pondering something, contemplating something, looking at it again and again, not quite knowing what's being said, not quite getting the surface, and therefore having to go below the surface for some comprehension. I like something that doesn't pretend that you can know it right away. And that's what separates opera from the made-for-TV special on rape. You know, Don Giovanni explores rape in ways that are more subtle and finally have greater implications. And you didn't have to understand Italian to figure that out. At the same time, anybody who cares to look at the Italian will learn a lot more. But the actual effort of looking, as opposed to, you know, the effort of going to the refrigerator for a sandwich in the middle of the made-for-TV special on rape, is what I'm talking about. Opera encourages an audience to actually read something, encourages the audience to have, you know, another layer of thinking going on.
But I guess what I'm wondering is that the composers of opera didn't mean for the audience to not understand the language itself. So I'm wondering why you choose to update part of the story while not translating the libretto into English.
Actually, Mozart wrote his operas with De Ponte in Italian for an audience in Vienna that really didn't understand Italian at all. I mean, that's one of the very interesting elements of those operas, is that for Mozart it was a choice to write it in a language that was not spoken on the street. What shall we say? I mean, I also love doing operas in English. I don't want people not to understand. But again, you get another level of meaning from a word that's sung than from a word that's spoken. And that's exciting and has its own mystery. And I'm not particularly anxious to turn on the floodlights. I love that something remains a little inaccessible, that something is still guarded. That's one of the beauties of opera, and that people are forced to take in the world through other pores.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is theater director Peter Sellers. He's directing the Los Angeles Festival, which will take place in September. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia. and distributed by National Public Radio.
Theater director Peter Sellers is my guest. You started directing when you were very young. I mean, you were directing on Broadway in your 20s, at the Kennedy Center in your 20s. Did you have the guts when you were that young? I guess you had to tell people who were older and much more experienced than you were that they were wrong and they should do it your way.
Oh, sure.
I mean, it's an odd position to be in, I think.
Yeah, but, you know, they don't hire you as the director to tell them what, you know, they think they want to hear. Or if they do, then you really should leave the room quickly. I mean, the only reason you're there is to be honest. I mean, that's what we're trying to do, isn't it? And so your job is to try and be as honest as possible, not to tell people what you think they want to hear, but to tell them what they have to hear. And, you know, that's the difference between, you know, it's about how you make a friend. You know, a real friend, you can tell them something they don't want to hear. Somebody who's not really your friend, you have to be polite. You know, my job is to make very, very deep, close friendships with people so that you can say something that's difficult and begin to probe and find some answers that are the result of really searching and asking and a kind of putting people in a situation that's as difficult as possible and then hoping and praying with them that they'll make it through. And, you know, that's your real job as a director, because that's what earns the moral authority to make a statement to the public, is if you really have been to hell and back and you can speak with some experience. And, you know, that's what's required on stage, is authority, not razzmatazz, but is the ability to speak with real authority of people who have made a long, hard, deep journey in their lives and have come back to tell about it.
Did you ever act yourself?
Only under extreme duress. I was King Lear my last year in college in my own production. I had to go in 3 days before opening because the person who was in the role suddenly withdrew. I also acted in Godard's film of King Lear.
Oh, that's
also,
right. That's right.
Again, accidentally. I never try and act. I prefer to direct. There are people who are really professionals. They should act.
So you never felt that you quite had it for acting, that your vision lay someplace else?
Well, yeah. I think I'm always thinking too much to be a good actor. You know, an actor, you want somebody who isn't thinking about it. They're doing it. They are it. And, you know, they're not thinking about being it, they are being it. And I think I probably think a little too much.
I remember Spalding Gray saying that he didn't think he could act on TV because you'd look at him on camera and he'd always look worried because he was thinking, and you have to have this kind of like blank face for it to really
it's
work.
It's true. It really is true.
Have you ever looked at one of your productions and thought, this didn't work?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you have to. I'm torn in two directions. I mean, one, of course, is I love my work. Otherwise, I wouldn't do it. And so I really love my productions, and I think people are shocked by how much I love them. At the same time, I am, as any of my assistants can tell you, I am so ludicrously hypercritical. I watch every performance in a state of such high anxiety. And at the end, I'm in such a black rage that the whole thing was a failure. And everyone comes up to me and says, no, it was just fine. But I'm always... all I can see is what isn't there yet in a performance. And it's very hard for me to endure a performance. I love rehearsals because everything's in the process of becoming. You know, you look at that scene and you say, well, that's where that is now, but, you know, it could go any direction, and you never know where it's going to go. And a performance, that's where it went that night. And it's always impossible for me to bear because I love living on the cusp of possibility. And at the same time, you know, I've done a few shows that I don't like, but most of them, I have to tell you, I work so long and hard on them, and I work with people who are so wonderful. I mean, the privilege of my life is to be in the room with really tremendous people that, you know, let's face it, I love them.
At the beginning of our conversation, you were talking about how discouraging it was to find that theater just wasn't where the action was anymore. The action was in movies and in music. What do you feel like your major contributions have been to trying to revitalize theater?
Well, I mean, it's early days yet. There's a lot more water to go under the bridge. I'm going to be very... I think theater will have a new birth in this decade. No question about it. It already is, again, at the community level, where very, very exciting things are happening in small communities around the country. What will happen is people will just genuinely crave authentic human contact, and theater will be the response for that. You know, my work is odd right now. I don't quite know where it's going. I haven't directed a theater piece in 5 years. I've been in a real moratorium on theater, and I've taken refuge in a world of opera where music has acted as an immediate agent of profundity, and where music explains to people why it doesn't look like television, because they're singing. Mm-hmm. And most theater, you know, keeps trying to look like television, which of course is a disaster area. And music at least explains that. People say, oh, that's why that doesn't look like television, because they're singing. At the same time, as I say, I think as people want to take their lives into their own hands, theater will become the language of choice again.
Tell me more about why you've declared this moratorium on theater, why it's been 5 years.
I felt there was no way that financially professional theater made sense right now in America. And, you know, actors are supporting themselves through television and through movies, and theater truly can't compete. And what it takes just to keep the doors open of any theater is so much money right now. And meanwhile, the theater is not making a commensurate civic contribution. You know, I didn't feel that we had the right to ask for that much support if we weren't pulling our weight in the community, if the theater wasn't serving as a vital force of a kind of glue in the community that was really addressing the issues that needed addressing. And so much theater was becoming an exercise in nostalgia and not keeping up with the pace of contemporary events and the complexity of contemporary events. But, you know, that old Einstein thing of everything should be stated just as simply as possible and no simpler. Theater kept being simpler. And now I think there's a chance that theater could be complex again. And you know, in the... in the strangeness of the kinder, gentler, and more eerie Bush years, there just might be a place again for you know, flesh and blood and the struggle. Let's see.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, please, Terry. Thanks a lot. Thank you.
Peter Sellers has been my guest, and Peter Sellers is a theater director, opera director, and director of the Los Angeles Festival, which will take place in September. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, we talk with columnist Christopher Hitchens. He writes for The Nation and Harper's. I hope you can join us.
As a kind of mystery, as a kind of mystery.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, comic David Brenner tells us a few things he learned from his father, a former vaudevillian and bookie. Also, critic at large Laurie Stone checks out comic Margaret Smith. Smith combines a deadpan delivery and a cynical outlook on life. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Soviet leader Gorbachev arrived at Andrews Air Force Base outside of Washington a short time ago for his summit meeting with President Bush. Greeting the Soviet president on his arrival was Secretary of State James Baker, who said the Cold War must be left behind.
To do that, we must see a Germany unified and Europe reconciled. We must reduce the danger of war by controlling nuclear, chemical, and conventional arms, and by resolving regional conflicts. And of course, we want to see continued movement toward democracy and openness in the Soviet Union.
Gorbachev, speaking through an interpreter, said that much depends on how his talks with President Bush develop.
Во многом будет зависеть, как пойдут дела не только у нас с вами, американцами, но и в более широком плане.
We are looking forward to important talks with President George Bush. A lot will depend on their results in determining how things will work out not only between you Americans and us, but also on a larger scale.
It's already apparent that German unification will be a key topic. Before leaving Canada earlier today, the Soviet leader said that Western leaders are trying to dictate, and there should be no attempt to dictate a solution to the German problem. The government of Nicaragua and the Contra rebels have come to terms. They have signed an agreement in which the government has made major concessions. For their part, the rebels have affirmed all of their troops will be demobilized in the next 11 days. Robert Meyerowitz has more on the story.
President Violeta Chamorro has signed a new accord with the Contras, promising them resettlement zones in southern Nicaragua, where they will be allowed to serve as their own police force. The government specified that the Contra police officers will fall under the government's jurisdiction. In return, Contra leader Israel Galeanos has affirmed that all of his estimated 13,000 troops will demobilize and disarm in the next 11 days. UN officials report that their demobilization centers are already full with rebels who are turning in their weapons. The government has promised to give the rebels land, houses, utilities, and health care in the new development zones. Before the new accord was signed, the Sandinista Party newspaper warned that a Contra police force would be dangerous and destabilizing. For National Public Radio, I'm Robert Meyerowitz in Managua.
The Commerce Department says the drop in the housing industry helped pull the government's key index of future economic activity down 0.2% last month. The government says that sales of new homes in April fell to an annual rate of 546,000 units, the smallest number since December of 1982. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 8 points to close at 2,878.56 in very active trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Comic David Brenner has been on TV a zillion times. He used to sub for Johnny Carson. Club dates and performances have taken him around the world. He's just written a comedy book about travel called If God Wanted Us to Travel. Of course, when David Brenner travels, everyone recognizes him. I asked him if that makes him self-conscious about sleeping on a plane.
What I do is I literally take a blanket and put it over my head, over my face, and I put the Do Not Disturb sign on the blanket, and all they see is what looks like a mummy is there. I cover up my face, yeah, because they see how you sleep. They want to see everything. They want to see how you walk, how you eat an apple. It's very nice. It's very flattering and all that, and endearing, I guess, but it's annoying. So what I do is I cover my head with a blanket.
Can you sleep that way?
Yeah, because what I put the blanket on my lap and over my knees, and then I pull it up, and I pull it on my head, and then I put my head back on the seat so it stays attached, and I go to sleep.
Stewardess to say anything?
No, I tell them ahead of time I'm going to do this because it frightens them. And I put the Do Not Disturb on the blanket.
And if you suffocated, they'd be held responsible.
Well, they wouldn't
right?
know it, right? You don't move under there.
Well, a lot of times when I travel, I feel it's like the me festival, because wherever I go, you know, the elevator is mirrored. You're waiting for the elevator. It's mirrored. Your hotel room, there's mirrors there, bathroom, mirrors all over. You just can't get away from your own face.
It's even worse for me. I'll tell you why it's worse for me, because if it isn't a mirror, or in addition to the mirror, if I'm working in that particular place, there's a picture of me in the hotel with elevator.
Right.
I walk to the lobby, there's a picture of me, and there are mirrors. I get in the hotel elevator, there's a picture of me, and mirrors. I get in the room in the hall, there's a picture of me, and then I get into my room, and then there's a little thing on the desk, and there's something in the bedroom saying I'm there. So I'm constantly surrounded by myself.
How do you deal with it?
I try to ignore myself as best I can.
Let's go back a ways to when you were growing up. Your father had been a comic. I think this might have been before you were born.
Yeah, it was way before I was born.
Okay, he was a vaudeville comic.
Comedian and a song and dance man, yeah.
Well, so what kind of material did he do?
If you were to take... My father had a premise, and his premise was, I like to catch the guy who says get married. I tell him blah, 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 blah. I like to catch the guy who paints houses. I like to catch the guy who fixed my car. I like to catch the guy who made my car and all that kind of stuff. And I didn't take that handle, but one day I realized that if you were to take my material and put in front of my humor, I'd like to catch the guy, it's applicable to about 90% of my humor. In a sense, I'm not a clone, but I was a student of my father. I loved my father. He was the funniest guy in the world and a great friend of mine. And I emulated him without realizing, even though he said, forget show business is bad, but being around someone so funny all the time, I just naturally picked up his ways.
How did your father bill himself?
He billed himself as Lou Murphy, and then he had a partner named Buster, and they were known as Brenner and Buster, and their handle was Listen to the Two Bees Buzz.
He billed himself as Murphy?
Yeah, because there was a lot of prejudice against Jewish people.
So he took an Irish
name? Yeah, and he looked Irish. And in those days, all the Jewish actors and all the way through, like Kirk Douglas and everybody changed their name. All the Jewish people changed their name in order to be in the business. And my father did the same thing. Plus, my father's family was a prominent rabbinical family in Philadelphia. The Brenners were very prominent. My grandfather, Nathan Brenner, was a top rabbi, and Jay Gerson Brenner, my uncle, my father's brother, was a very prominent rabbi. And he didn't want the name of Brenner being used in show business, which is actually the reason why he left show business. He came back to Philadelphia. He had a contract to do movies in Hollywood. And he came back to see his family before doing the movies, and his father said, you know, you can't work on Shabbat on Friday night. You just can't. It's against the tradition of our people. You're violating thousands of years of tradition. And my father ripped up that Hollywood contract and never went back on the stage again. And he did live his whole life regretting, not that he didn't listen to his father. He wanted to listen to his father, regretting that he couldn't do what he really was meant to do, and that was be an entertainer.
Huh. So what did he do when he got out of entertainment?
He did a lot of odd jobs. He was worked for the Philadelphia Record, which was a newspaper here, and he was with the Fairmount Park. He was in charge of the landscaping for Fairmount Park, and he was the manager of the Fairmount Park trolleys when they had him here. And then they went out of business. He was an insurance man, and then the main thing was he was a bookie. He was a numbers writer. That's the main. That was the mainstay of his income.
Did he have to do that on the Sabbath?
Yeah, he didn't take bets on Shabbat. Friday night, you come make a bet with Lou Brenner. But any other time, Saturday night, well, there were no numbers. I mean, Friday was over. There were no numbers on the weekend. See, so he didn't take bets on Friday night. He started taking bets against Sunday for the week. And he had a great talent. He could memorize all the bets without writing them down, so he could never get arrested. He had one shortcoming, though. He was a compulsive gambler with it, too. So when he would win, hit the numbers, he would play it back. Even though he was a bookie, he played it back with some other book or his own book. He'd make bets. And he was a real Damon Runyon character. He was a wonderful, wonderful character.
So your father was a bookie. Now, you play Atlantic City and Vegas all the time, where you have all these compulsive gamblers coming to be entertained after they've either won or lost a lot of dough. Are there things you have to keep in mind when you're playing a room in Vegas or Atlantic City where you know a lot of the people have been gambling all day?
You have to keep it in mind, because it's very difficult to make someone laugh who just lost a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
The big gamblers, it's easy to make them laugh. I always feel sorry for the small guy who lost the rent and all that. Well, he shouldn't be gambling. We all know that. But my father would sometimes lose the rent. I know what it's like to not have money because your father gambled it away. Gambling, like anything, is you take it in moderation. I've controlled it. See, I have a compulsive, I have an addictive personality too. And so what I do is I play poker for very little money. I stay up all night, and it gives me a chance to, one, get the gambling part of my personality exhibited and out, And the other gives me a chance to talk to regular people, because after the first few hands, it's no longer playing. They're no longer playing poker with David Brenner. I'm now an adversary. I'm just another poker player. And we can talk, and then I can be with everyday people, which I really enjoy better than being with celebrities.
Your first career was actually producing television documentaries.
Right.
And you didn't start being a stand-up till you were about 28.
Yeah.
How exactly did you get from documentaries to comedy?
I went to this island, Nevis. It's becoming semi-popular now. It was absolutely abandoned then. I rented this little house. I think the house cost me $6 a day or something, and I stayed there for 2 weeks. And I listened to the news. I said, people got to laugh. So I came back, and I thought, well, instead of trying to make a career decision, I'll postpone it for a year. I had $9,000. I'll postpone that decision for a year. I'll live off the $9,000, and I'll get up and do stand-up comedy. Why not? And after a while, I thought, well, I should do one television show, at least to keep the record that I once did this. And I went on The Tonight Show.
Well, how'd you get on The Tonight Show?
I auditioned, a cold audition. I walked in a room with a bunch of people, and I got up on a stage. I did 8 minutes of jokes, and that was right before Christmas. And January 7th, I got a call in the evening. You want to go on tomorrow night? I said, sure. I went on January 8th, and boom, that was it. A whole new world.
Now, you've done The Tonight Show lots of times, not even counting the times that you guest hosted.
It'll be 100. My next appearance will be my 156th appearance.
So, would Carson put you at ease? I mean, what would he do to help you that you tried to pick up on your own show and when guesting his?
I noticed he did two things. One, he listened to his guests. And two, he tried to make his guests the best they could be rather than compete with them or put them down. And therefore, if it were an actor or a comedian, he'd make that comedian the funniest that comedian could be. Feed him so he could be, or the actor, the most interesting and dramatic he could be. And at the end of the night, what I noticed the next day is people would say, did you see Carson? They all said, did you see Carson? Because Carson got the credit for it. He's smart. He made everybody the best they could be, which made him the best he could be. And I learned that from him and tried to do that in my own show and also when I was sitting in for him or any other television host.
Comic David Brenner is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Comic David Brenner is my guest. When you started doing comedy in, what, 68 or 69?
69. Like I started June of 69.
There weren't as many comics. It was before the comedy boom, before all the comedy clubs. And everybody had a niche, you know, like Robert Klein was the baby boom comic.
Yeah, the 50s, yeah. Steinberg was then. They were came before me, right? Steinberg, Richie Pryor, Cosby.
Yeah, Richard Pryor was like
they were the wave
the young,
before
hip,
mine.
Black comic.
Yeah, right.
So where did you see yourself fitting in?
I didn't at all. I was really different, and I did what they call, now they tag it, it's observational comedy, and that is to look at anything and find humor in it. The most mundane. A friend of mine, Richard Lewis, said you have monopolized the obvious. You have a monopoly on the obvious, he said. And I thought that was a good way of describing my comedy. And I just got up there and did what I did on the street corner here at 60th and Osage Street. I just got up in front of Moe's candy store. With my friends. I just got up and whatever happened. You know, car would go by, I'd make fun of car, person, boom, something would have, someone would say something, someone would say something dumb, and let's run, you know, like, come on, let's run. And I said, you're still walking. I don't get it. You know, let's run. And they don't run. You know how people always say that? Come on, let's run. Let's run over there. And they walk, you know. And all that all came from the street corner. That all came from West Philadelphia and South Philadelphia before that. So I didn't think of any. I just thought I'd just do what I think is funny. And then they tagged it, observational comedy.
You had been a pretty regular sub for Carson
for
a few years. Mm-hmm. When did you stop? Like, what were the reasons for stopping?
Well, I was the highest rated substitute host for about 3 years, up until 82 or something. And what happened is they came down with a decision at NBC, which I thought was, in spite of the fact that it put me out of a job and it was my favorite job, was hosting The Tonight Show. They decided to have a permanent host. Now, even though I was the highest rated host, I was very much like Johnny. You know, we're both men. We both do, you know, clean, squeaky clean kind of material. He has more of a little pex bad boy, a devilish thing in it. I have a little devilish thing in me, but not as much as Johnny. Basically, We're both monologists, and we do the monologues. Basically, we're similar. Even though he's from Nebraska and I'm from Philadelphia, there's some. So they wanted to get someone different that Johnny would be on, and then this person would be on, and we'd see the contrast, and also get the new audience that Johnny doesn't have, maybe, because Johnny's audience was always my audience and all. And they chose to go with Joan Rivers. And I think it was a wise choice because that's exactly what they achieved. I mean, she was bombastic, little, big mouth, blonde, you know, and she was like a tank with blonde hair and a total contrast to Johnny. And so the show just exploded thanks to her and the contrast with Johnny. So the decision was right. However, I was out of a job and never went back because then I had my own show. At the time, they were looking for another permanent host, and they gave it to Gary Shandling and Jay Leno. Gary got his own show, Jay Leno is. And I haven't hosted this show in the last six years, something like that. I think 84 is when I, up to 84, something like that. And that was my favorite job. I go on with Johnny now as a guest, but I haven't hosted it. I would love to.
How often are you on now as a guest?
Well, see, it's different now, too. See, when I was doing, you could go on 8 to 10 times a year. That's how I got to go on 156 times. Now they really don't want anyone on more than every 3 months. So that limits you to 4 times. So now I don't have the avenues that I used to have. I can only be on Carson 4 times a year. And all the other talk shows, let's face it, talk shows, there aren't that many, A. B, the talk shows aren't what they used to be. Now you have to be like a transvestite who eats dogs in order to get on a talk show.
You mean the morning shows?
Yeah, I mean all those talk shows. I mean, here we have women who hate men, who like to put needles in their face, and they ball with human heads. Today on Oprah. You know what I mean? I mean, what kind of shows are they? You know, and the public loves this. Or at least the ratings show the public loves this. What's David Brenner going to do? What does he do? He does, family kind of humor. You know David Brenner. You know, he does funny stuff. He'll make anything. He can talk about any subject. Yeah, but today we have pigeon-toed, sadistic, you know, right-wing skinheads. I mean, what am I going to do on that show? So the avenues are closed to me. And so I'm seeking a side door as a re-entry into keeping the career alive. And that's why I've gotten involved in, beside my personal love for the sport, in billiards. And that's why I'm doing billiards. I get a lot of publicity in billiards. I wrote this book. And also promoting the book and the billiard rooms and possibly doing a pilot for an idea of a billiard show that I came up with that's very appealing to the public and anyone can play it. So I'm keeping active. I'm still working the way I was and not as much, I don't think. First it was from choice, and now I think it's a matter of getting back and pushing those avenues that opened to me that used to be, I had so many. I'm in the book of lists having appeared as a guest on more talk shows than any other entertainer in the history of television. That's because the shows were there for me to get on, and I change my material all the time. I never repeat things, so... So I'm sure a side door is going to be the way back in.
What about the clubs and... You know, in the big rooms.
Well, the problem there, you see, is there's a dearth of big rooms and clubs. You have to be... The comedy stores, which are wonderful because they gave all these young men and young women an opportunity to go into the career, even though I think that comedy has become... It's almost like it's... I can see, I have this image of people sitting around in a dorm and saying, well, you know, I just finished my freshman year of liberal arts. I got to take I was thinking of pre-law or pre-med or comedy. It's like a field now. It's like anyone can choose it. Well, what do you think? Yeah, maybe I could do comedy too. Yeah. And a guy's never told a joke, or a woman's never, but they can do it. And it's like a lightweight kind of puffy, I'm not putting it down in the sense that I'm, like jaded and sour grapes. Look, I got my townhouse and my money's in the bank and I've been a star for 17 years. It's not that, and still do my work. It's just that it's very puffy. And so now, but the public has a choice. They can go see 7 or 8 new comedians, 4 of which will be really good, 2 are okay and 2 are terrible, but they'll have a good evening for this price. Or they can go see David Brenner, who they've seen 2-3 times, you know, like in this area, Valley Forge in Philadelphia or in Vegas or whatever. So let's go see the new comedians. So what happened with all these comedy clubs and people being saturated with comedy is that's what's happened. They've been satiated to the point where they don't go out to see. Now, if these clubs die off and there's a tendency to think that the comedy boom has boomed, then they may return to say, let's go see those few, you know, Lily Tomlin and Richie Pryor, not that they're not doing business, and Bill Cosby and David Brenner and Steve Landisberg, you know. Let's go back to our staple ones, you know, the reliable, the guys who are going to make us laugh, definitely make us laugh tonight. So I think there's a big change coming in comedy again.
So tell me what your schedule is like in the next few months. What kind of places are you working?
Well, I'm after the book tour, which is a whirlwind book tour. It takes me, you know, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, a book convention in Las Vegas for one night, and then Washington, D.C., New York. I'm taking a break at China. And after a little vacation in China, I come back, and then I start in with the nightclubs and not the colleges in the summer. And the club dates, a lot of club dates, organizations, conventions. And it'll take me to Acapulco, Mexico. It'll take me out there. Like I went a couple weeks ago, I was in Acapulco for a couple days. Then I was in Toronto, Canada for a couple days. Then I was down in Florida for a week. So I bounce around. I travel extensively. That's why I wrote the book, because I know a lot about the subject.
Does it still feel great to get laughs, having gotten them for so long?
My father, when I was a little boy, even though he discouraged me from show business, he said to me, he said, "Kingy, there is no greater feeling in the whole world than standing on a stage and hearing 1,000 people laugh at you." And I want to tell you, he said, if you make one person a day have a good belly laugh, then your life has been really worthwhile on this earth. And my father lived by that rule, and I've tried to live by the rule, because one of the sweetest sounds in the world is a genuine, honest laugh from someone.
What about bombing, though? Do you still bomb?
No, I don't bomb anymore, thank goodness. Not that I may not end up bombing. I have shows that aren't as good as other shows that are off. I'm off. But in the beginning, I bombed worse than anybody. They used to say, you know, oh, I bombed. They had an expression, I'm in a commode. It was in a commode. And I used to say, forget, I was like through the sewage system. I was out in the ocean. I was at the bottom. Whales were above where my bombs were. I was the worst bomber in the world for the first 3 months. My first night, I was really good. And after that, I was so scared. That I was doing an impression of myself in the first night. But I bombed horribly, but I haven't bombed in years because, you know, you're a household. I saw Bill Cosby when I was starting out. Cosby got up on a stage and said hello, and the audience laughed. And I said, see, that's when you know you've arrived, when you can just say hello. And one time when my career was just getting hot and I came out and said, hey, how you doing? And the audience laughed. I knew I had arrived.
David Brenner, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot.
And David Brenner has written a new book. It's called If God Wanted Us to Travel. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Getting ready for the summit?
We are, and so is the city of Washington. But we are preparing some advice for Mr. Gorbachev, Mr. Bush, some considerations for the summitry. We're also following the Soviet leader on his visit to Canada. There have been earthquakes, as you know, Terry, in Romania. We'll be watching that, and also earthquakes in Peru. The Republican Party in the state of New York has decided that the state platform should not call for any major changes in abortion laws in that state. We'll be looking at the Republicans and abortion.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Comic Margaret Smith sounds like a person trying to use a newly acquired foreign language. Her delivery is slow, studied, serious, different from the typical 60 laughs a second stand-up. Smith got her start at Second City in Chicago, has played all the big comedy clubs, and has made many appearances on David Letterman. Critic Laurie Stone has some thoughts on how Smith's act has evolved.
I first saw Margaret Smith 4 years ago at Caroline's Comedy Club in New York. She had a cool delivery and hot candor. Deadpan is a broad description of her slow, monotone delivery. Her scrubbed pretty looks and Midwestern twang contrast with the defiance of her stance. Her unnerving comfort with depression and anger is arresting, refreshing. I saw her a few weeks ago, again at Caroline's, and she was right on target, reminding the audience of childhood pain and licensing reprisals. She limps through family mayhem. She's bruised, pissed off, looking for a gun. She juggles ambivalence with ninja finesse, satirizing the impulse to suck on old injuries while bashing nostalgia and reporting hard truths. Her mother asks her when she's going to have kids, and Smith's eyes fill with dread.
Then she always gets to the part where she says, when are you going to have kids? You know, like I need a bunch of people hanging around my apartment. Yelling at me because I broke their yoke.
She admits she isn't trusting.
I can't get a relationship to last, like, longer than it takes me to tape their albums. Then I can't end one either, you know. I'm one of these spineless people. I don't like to hurt anyone's feelings, so I just, like, hope it goes away, you know. My ex-boyfriend's probably in therapy right now going, yeah, I don't know what happened, you know. All she said was, could you watch my purse?
And she's prone to sadistic traps. When she finally does see a therapist, the woman spooks her.
It's a new experience for me. I never had a therapist before, so I never know if it's a good therapist, you know. I go in there every week. I think, gee, she's crazier than me, you know. I don't know. Does your therapist have a balloon business on the side?
I had lunch with Smith, who's 35, a few days after I saw her perform. She explained that her knowledge of control, the power of conquering appetite and need, was acquired early and firsthand. Her mother showed her love by feeding her children too much food, and her father's medium was intimidation. Smith has boldly transformed these experiences in her work. She jousts with violence and hostility, ducking it, watching it with pleasure, threatening to unleash it.
Oh, yeah. I'm just so tired. The winter's over. You ever get so tired you slept with your mouth hanging open? You mean it leaks on your pillow? Wake up, you realize you're not at home, you're on an airplane? It's the guy's shoulder next to you. Then he has the nerve to go, you know, like I suggested, the light suit.
She taps subjects and feelings most women comics shun for fear of compounding the power role of stand-ups who wield mics and stalk stages. Smith has never been more confident, but her self-esteem can still waver. When people ask for her autograph, she thinks they're teasing her. She comes off vulnerable, but she's also undoubtedly getting her kicks.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and author of the new novel, Starting with Surge. Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers produce the interviews on Fresh Air with research assistance from Lisa McCullough and Dan Buskirk. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Christopher Hitchens is a British-born journalist who writes for The Nation and Harper's. On the next Fresh Air, Hitchens wonders why Americans are so absorbed in masterpiece theater, the monarchy, proper English, and other things he left home to get away from. Also, musician Jerry Harrison of the Talking Heads. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.